All right, Tim.
All right, Steve, how are you? We're back again. Exciting guests for our little show. A little tiny show in the corner of the world.
It's a tiny show, but we get big names. That's the thing.
We've got a very big name today from the Gone global today, truly global. We've got a lad called Junior Niem, originates from Cameroon, now in Carolina in the States. And he's, you may have heard him on the much more popular Johnny Prest live show, I imagine, that back in the day that you'll find on his Instagram. But he's got a good perception of what makes a brand remarkable. So I'm pretty excited
I'm really looking forward to this one.
Talking of remarkable brands, we've got a sponsor that's pretty remarkable called Bank.io. Roll the Bank.io thing. Just before we get cracking with this episode's guest, I want to shout out our very first sponsor, the amazing Bank.io, the all-in-one B2B lead generation toolkit designed to automate your customer acquisition. Now, we're all busy doing remarkable stuff. That's why software like Bank.io is super important to us, to help us manage our businesses and streamline our activities. So check them out in the show notes. All the links, all the info you'll need is in there. But now let's get on with this show. We've got a guest with us on screen that none of you can see because it's a podcast, but we have. And he's a very special guest. He's all the way from residing in Carolina in the US of A, across the pond, as they all say. So, Junior, why don't you say hello to the people, introduce yourself and what you do?
Hello, my name is Junior. And first of all, thanks, Steven, for having me. My name is Junior Niem. I'm originally from Cameroon, in Africa, and I've lived in the US now for 15 years. I arrived in the US on a full scholarship to play soccer and to study, in America. And I've been here ever since. It's been a tremendous journey, you know, of self-discovery, of growing. It's been full of interesting curves. I've met wonderful people. I met my wife here, my wife Kellen. We've been now married for 3 years. And when I was completing my MBA, I really fell in love with branding. I fell in love with the power that brands had to impact the culture and the relationship that the culture had with brands. I fell in love with the relationship that we as people have with brands and how at times we use them as substitutes or as ways to project our own identity. So I fell in love with that whole concept. So upon graduation, I decided that I wanted to be a brand strategist. And I didn't even know at the time what that meant. I just knew that I was curious about it and I just gave into that curiosity. And almost 10, 11 years later, here I am now. Now I run and I founded an agency, a branding agency, where we focus on helping companies find the truest expression of who they are and the contribution they want to make in the world. And it's been an adventure in and of itself, full of learning, full of challenges, but very, very much enjoyable and very much engaging to be a part of companies' mission and helping them shape and articulate their vision and be a part of the kind of contribution and impact that they make in the world. So, yeah, that's a bit of me.
That's a really interesting story. Now, we've been chatting online through various social medias for a while since you appeared on one of mine and Steve's friends' live shows. I don't know if it was podcast or whatever. Good old Johnny Prest. Hi, Johnny, if you're listening.
Hello, Johnny.
we stole one of your guests. Thanks, mate. Been kind of in touch in that weird place of social network, and a word that comes a lot into fruition in your posts and on your content that you've got on your website and stuff, which we will stick in the show notes, is empathy, right? And I think that's a interesting place to start the conversation, because both I and Steve, as we said, from a human-centered design background, so using that way of thinking and using anything with kind of purpose or brand, you know, anything with people at the heart of it, starts off with understanding, right? Because we've all got knowledge and information, like we're surrounded by bits of data, we've all got supercomputers in our phone pockets, right? We've got a lot of knowledge and information, but it's the difference between that and the understanding or the narrative or the empathy you can build around it that makes those data points, those bits of information actionable and meaningful, right? So how did, like, tell us what it's about empathy that's important to you and how that relates to your definition of brand, Junior.
Yeah, I mean, up 3 years ago, I started a newsletter that I send out every 2 weeks. And unintentionally, I realized that the through line that stitched together almost all of those entries was empathy. I realized that I mentioned that word so often, and I became intrigued by why that was the through line that stitched together everything that I was talking about and I was writing about. And I became very, very interested and curious about empathy and how that plays a role in branding and marketing. And the gist of it that I realized is we have no direct access to the experience of other human beings. Everything we experience, we do within ourselves. And that's an interesting dilemma for entrepreneurs and marketers who, by definition, are trying to bring new ideas, new product, create experiences for other people to enjoy. And if we have no direct access to the experience of other human beings, no direct access to their thoughts, to their feelings, to their emotions, to their fears, to their wants, their needs, their insecurities, then how could we possibly bring to market new ideas and products and experiences that they will find enjoyable, that they will find useful or fascinating? And it became obvious and apparent to me that the bridge to those experiences was empathy, was our ability to put ourselves in other people's shoes, our ability to understand what makes them tick, what motivates them, what fears and insecurities and aspirations drive them. And I realized as I continued on this journey that almost all of the challenges that I see in marketing and branding could link back to some level of lack of empathy, that we don't understand who the people we seek to serve are, or we come at the decision that we make through the vantage point of our own wants and needs and aspirations. I always say that there is a bit of friction between what we want and what our customers need, and that our fates are intertwined in that we can only get what we want if we are able to deliver what they need. And it naturally forces us to understand, or at least try to understand, to some level what they need, what they expect from us. But the best, of course, take it a step further and do what you guys do, human-centered design, and they understand other people and put those people at the center of everything that they do. So I've been fascinated by that idea of reconciling and closing the gap between our experience and the experience of other people, so we can communicate with them, so we can connect with them, so we can serve them, so we can help them achieve their goals, their aspirations, and yeah, that's where and how I link all these things in my personal life and in business and in branding.
When you go through empathy-driven activities, Junior, do you have a starting point with your where you believe that empathy sits and then work from there, or do you literally go into it with an open mind and believe it can be taken anywhere? And then also after that, where does the empathy piece stop? And I don't mean it ever stops, but where does it stop having influence in products or service or brand? Where does it, or do you just continue to keep going further and further down that empathy funnel until it, which never ends realistically?
Yeah, I mean, I think paradoxically, the starting point, at least in my mind, for empathy is self-awareness. Is that if you take a human being, in order for me, the more I understand myself, the better, the deeper I understand myself, the better I'm able to empathize with other human beings because I see and hear myself in their experience, even if it doesn't mirror mine. Right? Because I'm now in tune with my fears, my insecurities, my hopes, my dreams, and my aspirations. I can see and hear those things in other human beings, even if the experience don't actually mirror mine. And I think that's a great starting point, at least on an individual base. And I think as far as companies and brands are concerned, a good starting point is really about understanding who you are as a company. Again, is that's again some level of self-awareness, understanding who you are, why you exist, and what contribution you want to make in the world. Understanding that your product, your service is always a means to an end. And if we can understand what the end is, then we can walk backward to try to understand how we can bring that vision to life. And we can walk backward to understand, if we understand what customers the customers you are trying to serve are trying to achieve, how they are using your product or your service, to what end they are using it, then we can walk backward to try to help them get there. So that's always the starting point for us. The starting point is, who are you as a company? Forget about outside noise. And let's try to take you guys on a journey of self-inquiry and discovery to understand why you exist, who you are, and what contribution are you seeking to make in the world?
Yeah, I think that there's quite a few things in there. Like I've always started work off with, I use the same phrase as you, discovery, right? Because I think there's a lot of people in the brand and marketing place and in consultancy that like come with the answers, like have to use a poor analogy, like have a 10-point system. Like, you know, and they're trying to sell a product or a framework or a funnel, which is just a funnel. You know, they build everybody through. But I think it's people like yourself and the work that we do is that, like, sometimes the answers aren't known. They're discovered through doing the work, right? Do you know what I mean? And I think that element of building client relationships, you know, getting somebody to choose you when you don't know the answer. Do you know what? Like, yeah. is an interesting thing, right? And it shows, I think it links back to what you mentioned there, which I haven't heard before, but it was really interesting. The start to being good at empathy, right? Being able to use empathy strategically for your work or for your clients' work is self-awareness, right? Like knowing yourself. Without that level of understanding of who you are and what drives you, how can you possibly then help others? I thought that was super interesting, that point.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, again, it started with my own experience. I just realized that the more time I invested in trying to know myself, in trying to pick apart the belief that I owned versus the belief that I borrowed, the aspirations that were mine versus those that were just the result of society, of me trying to emulate people that I admired or look up to. The more I did that work, the more I got in touch with my own fears and insecurities, the more I could empathize with other people because I recognize in them the things that I see in me. And it doesn't, again, I think it's powerful because even when the experience doesn't exactly mirror ours, we know it. You know, mine doesn't look like this, but I have something like that in me as well. And the more we do that, I think the more we realize just how much common ground there is versus all the things that seem to separate us as people.
Mm-hmm. There's something really interesting there, which you've mentioned a couple of times, which is around fear and insecurities. And you know, when you say to somebody, oh, describe yourself, everybody puts on that sell, don't they, straight away, and it's all positivity time after time after time. And actually, I think the route to self-awareness, you're completely right, is understanding fears and insecurities. And I like that you think that self-awareness is the beginning of empathy. I'm in complete agreement, because I think the beginning of empathy is when you can understand your own unconscious bias. Because as soon as you understand your own unconscious bias, you can start to understand other people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It allows you to understand just how subjective your reality is. And once you accept that your reality is subjective, it opens you up to try to understand how other people form their reality and what are the commonalities and where are the points of distinction and all that. And right. And I think the moment you accept that reality is subjective, it just opens up a whole new world for you, because now you just open to the fact that there are other reality as valid as yours that exist out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It's really interesting, especially in this country at the moment, especially in the UK where we are, Junior, you know, we are in a very polar opposite version of what the world is at the moment, as I suppose it has been in America for a few years as well with the government.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely.
And actually, I always have this debate, especially with my wife. She doesn't listen to this podcast, so it's fine, I can say this.
But, I have a feeling, you know, she will listen to this episode.
Yeah, she will listen to this episode because you're on it, Junior. But, you know, usually it's like, why do I need to listen to Tim and Steve? But we have this thing where, you know, there's very polar opposite on it should be done this way or it should be done that way. You know, Brexit, no Brexit, all these different things. And I was always in the middle, not of which way to vote. I knew which way I was going to vote, but I could see both sides of everybody's story. So I was going, yes, but from this person's perspective, in this different landscape, living in this place in the country, I can understand why they're thinking that. And I can understand it from this perspective as well. And it just showed to me at the time that actually I was empathetic to both audiences. I knew one audience was completely wrong, but that was my unconscious bias saying that audience was wrong. It's hugely interesting that being self-aware gets you to understand people more.
I
think it's one of the reasons we started this podcast is because the people we talk to, whether it's about, you know, themselves or whether it's about the work they do in their business, is that they do something different, right? They think a little bit different than other people, right? We use the word remarkable, right? But not as in as you stand out, you wear clown outfits to work, right? Not that sort of work, but you're worth remarking on, right? Yeah, no judgment, Junior, if that's what you do. But it's fine.
I already took the dig.
If it's worth remarking on, if there's something that you tell somebody else, like a teachable lesson, from this thing. And I think the first big takeaway, which is really good, this early in the podcast is really good, is that self-awareness piece, right? Because that confidence, that knowing of your own identity, of what it is, right? It's the foundation of being confident enough to help other people change, right? To drive people to do stuff that maybe they wouldn't. Maybe it's a bit scary.
How often have you guys worked with clients that are completely distracted by competition? Right, they're completely distracted by competition, they're distracted by market trends because they have lost touch with why they started this business in the first place and the impact that they wanted to make in the world and the contribution they wanted to make. So to bring them back to that founding core, to that founding ideology is super, super important to help them understand and to allow them to have the courage to zig when everybody's zagging, because it's very difficult to zig when everybody's zagging unless it's grounded in something that is really fundamental to who you are and what you believe. Then you say, "This, I am willing to live by this choice because it's grounded into something that I feel strongly about." But when it's not grounded in something as powerful and as strong, then it's so easy to follow the trend, and it's a lot harder to not follow the masses and to do your own thing, which incidentally is what we need to do to succeed, especially in branding and in business. And
it's a good point that you make. I think we see lots of examples, like I'm sure you do on in your market as well, right? That some companies have chosen to decide to stand out, right? So they've gone a bit wacky. Do you know what? Maybe everything they do is orange from now on, for no reason apart from they wanted to stand out. And then there's companies who stand out because the meaning that you attach to their brand is something, well, there's just more meaning, right? There's a depth to the value we associate with them, right? The perceived value of their products and service is different, which is, you know, you in one of your websites as well, you refer to a thing like a businesses having soul. And I think it's that intangible stuff, right? The amount of empathy they have, the amount of understanding they have. So if you... like, what would be the ingredients of the soul of a business? How would somebody build a remarkable brand from that, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the starting point is being clear about who you are, why you exist, your mission, your vision. You know, what is the contribution that you want to make in the world? And then if you have a mission, you have a purpose, and you're trying to make a contribution to the world, then there is a group of people that you have decided that are going to be the beneficiary of this thing that you are building. You are trying to solve a problem for a group of people, or you are trying to improve the lives or the human experience for a group of people. And if that's the case, and if that's genuinely the case, then that has to be the driving force behind everything that you do, and it has to be the top priority above everything else. Everything else has to be subservient to that mission, to that purpose, and to that group of people that you are trying to help. And that translates then into, let's go back to the piece of differentiation. Differentiation that lacks empathy is exactly what you're talking about. It's differentiation that is geared to standing out. But differentiation, the goal of differentiation, in my opinion, is not to stand out. The goal of differentiation is to create unique value. And that's subtly different, right? Because if the goal is to stand out, then yes, I can just create this very bright neon thing and it works for a bit. Maybe it brings a little bit of curiosity, but true differentiation is because you have brought to market something that is a unique value. You have created a unique value for a group of people in a specific market. So the idea is always to have the courage and the humility to do your best work and to do what is best for the people you seek to serve. And if you keep them top of mind, then it will, in most cases, naturally let you know what the right decision and the right path are, in most cases. We talked again about different about competition, for example, being a distraction, right? So if the goal is to help enhance the human experience for a certain group of people, then we have to decide what do we add to this cause. So I always take the example of two companies that are out to cure cancer, for example, right? They're out to help cure cancer. If we found out that those two companies were competing ferociously, we will scratch our heads because it wouldn't make sense, because they're all trying they both have the same cause. Now, one of them has to decide that if we're both going for the same cause and this person is doing this thing to advance the cause, it doesn't make sense for me to do that too. I have to find another way to advance the cause. So we talk a lot about competitive allyship, which essentially just means that we believe that companies within the same category and the same industry are out to solve the same problem for the end user. They are allies. They might disagree on the best way to get there. They might disagree on what's the right solution. You might have a newer way, a better way, a cheaper way. You might address a segment of the market that all the industry leaders have neglected. But fundamentally, we are out to solve the same problem. And if we look at each other as allies and not as enemies, then we have to justify our existence and we have to articulate what it is that we bring to the market that currently doesn't exist, right? So that's competition, but that's competition from a level of empathy for the people that we are seeking to serve.
That's really, that's really interesting. It made me think a lot of things, actually. I was talking this morning to a group of businesses through a university here I do some things with, and it was in and around just people's opinion and perception of vision, mission and values, right? So it's working in business education. So I know you've got an MBA, right? So executive education sort of level. So, and there was a, because the world and business models have changed a lot because of COVID and all that stuff we've mentioned, blah, 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 right? And I think that the fluidity of business models have changed. They've not been so static and probably won't be going forward because of technology advancements, for example, right? And behavior change in consumers, right? Do you think that along with the competitive alliance, two companies may have the same kind, a similar vision, right? Something that they want to check, like go towards, right? And because they believe in that vision, they probably have similar values, say 60% similar values and 40% what makes them. But how changeable is the mission bit? So the what we're going to do to get there. And if it is changeable, if a business changes the way it shows up in the world, not the direction it's going, not what it's trying to achieve, like what kind of a effect does that have in the people it serves? Does it affect trust or anything like that? Does it help them? Does it look? Yeah, how is it perceived by people, do you think?
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, I know some people use purpose and mission interchangeably, but for me, your purpose is the bit that almost never changes,
yeah.
And your mission can't, agreed. Right? So for me, the way we do it is that we try to set a purpose that transcends your current product or service. Something that will exist if your current business model was wiped out, right? So we can say, for example, that I always take the example of two companies that sell sunglasses. Company A defined its purpose as to create the best, greatest sunglasses in the world. Everything that they do is to serve that purpose. They hire the best engineers, they push the envelope on the color and the glass to make sure it gives UV protection. They push the envelope and they market themselves as the best sunglasses in the world. Company B defines its purpose as to protect the human eye. And they too hire the best designer, they push the envelope on the glass and the but because their purpose transcends the current product, they are also experimenting with contact lenses and eye drops that may provide a higher UV protection. So for us, it's always like, what is the fundamental purpose of your company? And what is the mission that will allow you to move the needle on that purpose? And for individuals, I always say to them, if your purpose is to be a police officer, for example, if for some reason you can no longer do that, you have lost your purpose. But if your purpose is to protect people, is to save lives, then if for some reason you can no longer be a police officer, your purpose was fundamental enough that it transcends that police officer, and you can find other ways to do that. You know, I can save lives as a doctor, as a teacher, as a there's so many ways, different missions, but the purpose itself remain. So for us, that's one of the very first things that we try to do is let's take a step back. I know this is what you do right now, and this is the mission that you guys have, but fundamentally, what is the purpose that is driving your effort? And I think once companies do that, one, it allows them to be able to pivot without it feeling too out of left field. But two, it drives innovation in a way that doesn't make it too in a way that keeps it coherent, because the purpose is wide enough to support different brand expansion in different directions.
That's really good.
That's a proper answer to your question, Tim.
A proper answer. I was just thinking that. I don't know what to say in response to that, apart from yes.
I love that, because that missions can change. Purpose should never change. If purpose changes, then it's a different company. It's a different organisation. So, you know, I think I referred to it in one of our previous podcasts on the marketing podcast, Tim, when I was talking about the bike brand Orbea, that before that was actually a gun making. It used to make guns for the Spanish army. And then they changed, kept the name, but they became a completely different company. They needed a whole different set of skill sets. They needed a whole different set of machinery. It was a different company. And it was actually, it was more of a revolution than an evolution of a company state. Purpose changed, everything changed. Whereas, and I referred to this in one of this, a more recent podcast, Nintendo, for example, who has always been about bringing families together to have fun, have changed their mission and their vision multiple times, because they once had a hotel so families could stay together. They had a pack of playing cards, and now they're doing it through technology. They're just evolving, but always following the same purpose of people getting together to have fun. And it's as soon as you play with purpose, you become something different. But everything else is changeable as long as it's working towards that same purpose.
Absolutely. We call it the product-centric trap. And I can hear it right away when I come with a company. I can hear that they are trapped by the current product and service.
Yeah.
And we need to figure out a way to save them from that trap. And I think the companies that were trapped, that were product-centric trapped, really, really struggled to pivot with COVID, because COVID forced people to really pivot and reinvent themselves and change. And I think the ones that did that successfully are the ones that, like Nintendo, had a purpose that was a little bit more fundamental to the human experience and how they wanted to enhance it versus their current product line or service.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting when you start looking, especially through COVID, and how people were forced to pivot or change the way that they offer their service. You know, here's a question for you, Junior, on that. How many do you think will revert back to what they were doing before? How many do you think will keep two forms of revenue lines coming in through the new way that they did it through COVID, through pre-COVID? Or how many do you think will go, let's stop everything that we did and just do the new bit? Because I've got this funny feeling that there's a lot of people going to try and revert back to what they used to do beforehand. And it concerns me a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I think it will really depend on how the pivot and the transition is happening for them. Because if it's working, if you see a line of business that a new line of business that has prospect and it is promising, then it's very unlikely that they will change. So I think it really depends on how well the company was able to pivot and to add those pieces. And the ones that I think haven't figured out the bit are itching to go back to a world pre-COVID.
Yeah.
I think that's quite interesting, because I was doing a lot of work. There's a city here where I live in the outskirts of a city called Derby. It's pretty much in the middle of the UK. And there's part of a thing called the City of Culture bid. So in Europe, we have some places, locations are awarded a thing called the City of Culture. Right, which means you get a lot of kind of press and tourist thing about it. But a big part of that is the personality of a city centre, right? Like the thriving bit, which involves retail, for example. So I know on the COVID example that Steve brought up, a lot of retailers had their business models stopped. Right in the middle of things, because we weren't allowed to go to shops. I don't know what it was like for you guys, but here we weren't allowed to go into shops technically, especially non-essential shops. We're talking like supermarkets were open, obviously, and food shops, but like non-essential shops. But a lot of people have developed either using third-party marketplaces like Etsy or Amazon or another kind of marketplace to sell their goods for delivery, or developed their own delivery networks, right? So people who are fans of those independent shops of that town are now used to being able to get it on demand, right? Without having to drive the 3-4 miles or walk the kids in or find somewhere to park and go into the shop, right? And I think it's a dilemma. That choice is a dilemma for many, because this, on paper, as a business strategy, as a business model strategy, right, may look like it's great, but does it dilute the thing that made people choose that brand anyway, which is probably the retail experience, right? It's not, people don't sell unique products very often.
So quick, just to add to that, Tim, and it's triggered a thought, because I was thinking of a completely different company when I was going through it before, but on retail, so here's a prime example of this. When COVID hit in the UK, Junior, we've got a huge clothing chain called Primark. I don't know if it's in America or not, or if it might be like JCPenney in America, I think.
Or Target, yeah. Or something, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But so it's cheap, low-end fashion, which is really quick turnaround, etc. But it's one of the biggest clothing superstores in the UK. When COVID hit, it did nothing. It didn't put anything online. It didn't change its business model. It still doesn't do anything online. Actually, it just waited for the world to open back up again. Whereas others rushed to do things online. And it's a really interesting viewpoint from Primark. I found it hugely interesting. They didn't know how long they was going to be closed for. They didn't know if customers were going to come back or not. And I still don't know if they know that. But it's just companies acting in different ways. And COVID was a pivot point. So if you didn't pivot, are you now at risk of not being there in 5 years' time?
For me, it goes back to the product-centric trap. If you define yourself through what you do, then your whole identity as a company, as a brand, is entangled in that, and is a lot harder to pivot. But like, if you define yourself by the way you want to reach your customers and enhance their life and help them solve problems, then you understand that the retail or the current way of delivering that on that thing is just a means. I can find another way to get to the same outcome, to help my customers in the same way. And I think that's the trap. The trap is, this is my identity, this is who we are, and it's harder to change when you have defined yourself in that way. So I always try to steer clients away from that kind of attachment to their current product line, business line, and get them thinking about the fundamental way they're trying to enhance the human experience. And the moment we do that, just a whole new world opens up in their mind. Even if they were not thinking about innovation and adding product, and they start seeing all the possibilities that are opening up for them, that will still stay on brand, quote unquote, and remain true to who they are.
I don't know about you, but I've over the past, I don't know, 2-3 years, and the reason that, you know, I'm not saying come out of marketing, because I haven't come out of marketing, but I don't class myself as a marketeer anymore, is I feel that good marketers are actually better, understand business better than most people. And actually, when you class yourself as a marketeer or, you know, brand, for example, Junior, people have one very specific thing in mind. Actually, you know, listening to you talk today, it's you're more of a business consultant than you are just somebody who's an expert in brand. And I think there's a lot of us out there who have made that switch now to understand that actually it's an intrinsic part, brand, but actually business operations and the way that company structure works and all those different things are what actually make the brand.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, to that same point, I'm very reluctant to call myself a marketer or a brand strategist, because it's like it entangles my identity with that thing. And it's exactly the way we're talking about product-centric trap. It makes me be trapped into this role and this persona versus a more expansive thing where I'm trying to help companies and leaders find the truest expression of who they are and the contribution they want to make in the world. And there are multiple ways to do that, and branding happened to be one of them.
I think that's, I have that exact issue. Like I have, like there's anything that starts, I have an issue about identity because it comes with baggage, like especially marketing, I would say, after spending 20 odd years in marketing, right? Like if you meet somebody in a networking environment, for example, you go, oh, I'm in marketing. They go, oh, right. And they already have judged you with what their version of marketing is, and you go, it's not that, I don't do it for people, like we make, and you have to justify it. So I've had a real issue with labels and job titles and things, because they come with so much baggage and I don't feel the need. I think it comes down to that self-awareness, right? Once you get to a certain level of self-awareness, like any label doesn't quite fit. You could call me a brand strategist if you like, and I do some brand strategy. But I don't just do brand strategy. You can call me marketing strategy, right? And I just don't do marketing strategy. You can call me a human-centered designer. I don't just do human-centered design. Like it's a recipe, right? They're all ingredients to the work I do to fulfill my personal and vocational purpose, right? Because I know what I frame it as connectedness, right? So I know if I'm working on a project or talking to somebody that's not connected with me, I can physically feel it like disconnected and go, do you know what? This isn't for me. Sounds like a great idea, but I'm not the guy you need for that, right? Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And especially aligns with, actually, this might be an interesting question to, we should call this, Steve, the interesting episode, because all me and you have done, John, that was interesting. through the thing. But a good point to end with, right? How do you, with so much, like we all understand the value of purpose, and you've communicated it better than most, right? You've got, like, you really kind of eloquently put the ideas forward that you have, like, really good. But where does it sit in line with the bigger picture stuff? So if we're looking at diversity, equality, climate, that businesses should be responsible now in all of those big picture, global, even national things, right? Obviously, they've always been around, but they are definitely, people are definitely more aware of them. Consumers and customers are definitely more aware of them. And they're definitely a choice factor now, right? Of how you choose to buy from a brand, those sort of things. How do you see them aligning with, like, the diversity, equity, and climate, let's say, right? With that, a brand's stance on those three big issues that exist with their purpose? Like, should it be entwined with the purpose? Should it show up in values? Like, where do you think that fits?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, is values are super important, right? I think from the purpose, we get to the mission, and then we get to the company's core values. And whatever those things are, the next challenge is to try to figure out how to bring those things to life. How can we operationalize them? How can we use them as filters to make decisions? And so that they move beyond being nice things on the wall or nice things on a document, but they become actual filters for how we make decisions and how we explain our stance around those issues, right? And I think that's the challenge. And that's, for me, that's one of the things that I really want to get better at. I really want my agency to get better at, is this idea that culture and brands are two sides of the same coin. And that is not good enough to just create this beautifully written and crafted brand platform that then doesn't inform and influence the culture and the choices that people make and the behaviors and the habits within that organization. That if you have stated that you are the kind of company that in some ways want to enhance the human experience, then naturally it should factor in things like diversity and climate change and all these bigger issues, because fundamentally your purpose is some variation of enhancing the human experience. And every one of those is an opportunity for you to show that purpose in action. And that's also how you build a brand, by being able to point out to these things in action.
Yeah, that's I'm not going to say interesting again. Really try not to say interesting again. But it is. But there's, like, so do you think, because I've seen a lot of examples where companies obviously are, I think, if I'm being honest, between us three, because nobody will listen to the podcast, that driven a bit by fear and thinking people should have a stance, right? They should stand for something on this thing, and then have used it by default, and I think this is an action of a lot of people, but have started to put it in their marketing communications. Right. I think, Steve, we talked ages ago in season one of the first iteration of the podcast about the sky thing.
Yeah.
You remember with the dolphins?
Yeah. So when Sky TV did the ocean rescue thing about taking plastic out of the ocean, it's like, hang on, that. You're jumping on a bandwagon. Yeah. You weren't, it wasn't a core essence of what your company's trying to achieve. You're a TV broadcaster. Don't be trying to, if you are fundamentally going to change your business to help achieve that, great. But I tell you what, stop using water bottles inside your offices straight away.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I was just going to say, that was just one really good example of them just going, oh, we love dolphins, we want to save the dolphins, plastic is bad. And people going, right, like everybody likes dolphins. Everybody thinks plastic is, but like, what are you actually saying? Right. Sorry, Gina, I interrupted. You carry on.
No. I was just saying we use this analogy of being a mirror brand versus being a window brand.
Awesome.
And the analogy is a mirror brand reflects to the world what they think the world expects from them, even if it's not exactly who they are. And a window brand reflects to the world what's on the inside. It allows people to see what's on the inside. And I think that's exactly what we're talking about here, is that companies are being pressured to have a stance and to respond to some of these issues. But they don't understand that without some fundamental and structural changes to their organization, it's just, they're just saying nice things, right? But one of the things that I really love about the relationship between brands and culture is that brands have the power to change the culture. In that, you know, when you have a company that has the kind of pull and influence that Coca-Cola or Apple has, they truly have the power to change ideas around important issues and to move the needle around important issues. But the relationship is so that culture also sometimes apply pressure on companies and brands to revisit some ideas that we have decided as a society, as a culture, are now outdated. And I find that relationship absolutely beautiful, that a company like Dove can really help amplify what it means to be, like, what ideas around beauty means, but that consumers also have the power to say, we want you to be more transparent about how you treat people, where you source your thing, and force companies to structurally change the way they do business because the culture is applying pressure on them. And I love that relationship. And I think is a relationship that is super important for our culture and our civilization to move forward.
Yeah, I can't agree more. And with kind of a respect of your time, and we're coming on that, I don't want to open the culture conversation now because we could be another 3 hours, but maybe you should come on and we could have a conversation about culture, because that's a topic that matters a lot as well, I think. But to round today off, I think you are truly a remarkable brand strategist. That, like, the way you've described a lot of the things that me and Steve have worked for many years in, right? And we understand has been really good. And I think our audience will understand what those ingredients of building a remarkable brand are. So I thank you for your time. Steve, any final comments before we Gina to round off?
No, what I'd like to say is I'm actually walking away from this conversation feeling a lot clearer about things, which is, you know, there's not many conversations you get that. So I really appreciate you coming on, Junior.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you, Tim. Those are high praises. So I really, really am humbled by your comments. And I'm so, so, so grateful that you had me on. This was a wonderful conversation. And as you can tell, I love having these conversations. Yeah. I have too many of them with myself. So it's always good to have other people that I can share these ideas and yeah. get some feedback on.
At least when you have that conversation with yourself, you're very self-aware. So at least you're telling yourself the real thing, Junior.
Yeah. It was a good decision to have you on. But to round off, Junior, why don't you let people know where they can best connect with you or find out more about you and the work you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best two places are probably LinkedIn, where it's just Junior Nyemb, NYEMB. And Instagram. Again, is junior_Nyemb. And that's it. I think I try to have so many of these conversations out there. Those formats do not always allow for the kind of depth that we had today and that you can have on a longer form. So I feel like I'm sometimes putting out half-baked ideas that don't seem that they actually make sense. So again, I'm very grateful to have this kind of opportunity to dive a little bit deeper on some of those things, because as important as brevity is, it doesn't always serve us well.
Good answer. Well, thank you very much for coming on. This episode will be out. We'll put all the links to Junior's LinkedIn and Instagram and his websites in the show notes, and we'll translate our longest show notes ever with all the key bullet points, because I think everything was a key bullet point. But with that, I think we're done, Steve.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Junior.
Thank you very much for having me. Thank you.
Take care. Goodbye, people.